Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. This is Ellie Steele and Lila.
I'm here.
And tonight we're going to do some news and views.
Ordinarily we have our recorded interview, but we were unable to record it accurately, so we'll be reading more news tonight rather than bringing you that interview, which is too bad because it was very good.
Yeah, it was a very good interview, and unfortunately, these things happen. But tonight we're going to start off with a couple of things. This one here. I don't know if you wanted to read this letter or not. About forcing body scanners on people?
No, I'm tired of that.
They're doing it, trying to do it, yeah.
This is what's going to happen to us. European Union tells Britain it must give welfare to migrants. Benefit tourists are set to get the green light to come to Britain and immediately claim handouts totaling £2.5 billion in a year. According to documents leaked to the Mail, ministers have been warned that restrictions on claims by immigrants are against the law and must be scrapped. The European Commission's ruling threatens to open the door to tens of thousands who are currently deterred from coming to Britain.
That's happening now with us. I mean, we're in our country, it's getting that way.
Mm-hmm.
And at the moment,
a habitual residency test is used to establish whether migrants from the EU are eligible for benefits. To qualify for job seekers allowance, employment support allowance, pension credit, and income support, they must demonstrate that they either have worked or have a good opportunity to get a job.
But after receiving a complaint that the rules infringe the human rights of EU citizens, the Commission began to examine them. In a letter seen by the Mail, it warns that the restrictions are not compatible with EU law. It says EU law leaves it to member states to determine the details of their social security schemes and social assistance schemes, including the conditions on awarding benefits. However, when making use of this competence, member states have to comply with the fundamental principles of EU law. That is not compatible with different legal provisions of EU law.
In other words, Britain gave up its sovereignty, and now it has to do whatever the EU tells them.
That's right. And
that's what they want to do here with the North American Union.
That's right.
So if we decide that we want to do things in a certain way, it won't matter.
Oh.
Decisions will be made by some bureaucrats you didn't even elect.
And that's what
bad enough the way the Congress is, you can't hardly influence them. But when you have, like for instance, in the European Union, somebody in Brussels that you don't even know and never heard of makes the decision about what's going to happen in your country.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't toss them out.
And that's why there's this big argument about state rights right now.
You don't want to have that.
What, state rights?
No, you don't want to have a union like the European Union.
Oh, God, no, a North American Union or anything.
No.
It's enough that we have the state rights, and states can pass their own laws and so on and so forth.
I think that's important.
And I think that is why the Constitution was made that way, so you don't have that problem. This is kind of interesting. I don't know if you'd want to...
Okay.
But,
the fake alien invasion operation has been mentioned by numerous NWO writers over the years. I first read of it in Bill Cooper's book, Behold the Pale Horse. Don Cross mentioned in a few of his adventurous escapades that the not-so-secret inner government had obtained large spacecraft from the B-Syrians for the purpose of staging the phony alien invasion scene. Red Elk cautioned against the idea of allowing yourself to be beamed up into an alien spacecraft when things get rough. I'm afraid that a lot of people will think that this is the rapture. In fact, the incessant preaching about the coming rapture may have been set up to prepare them for this. I don't know for certain. But according to Red Elk, it's not going to be exactly heaven when those people wind up. Where those people wind up.
Bear in mind the larger game. The inner government had made a secret deal with negative alien groups in 1947. which was formalized in a treaty in 1954 under Eisenhower. The agenda has grown more negative and destructive as the years rolled on. The Illuminati wants to reduce the world population down to 500 million. The negative aliens, on the other hand, want to take over the planet completely and use it as a Stargate jump-off point into other dimensions to extend their empire. Now, hang on a second. Interesting.
The bad guys plan on getting rid of large numbers of people through their contrived wars, through bioplagues, through vaccine-induced illness, through chemtrail poisoning, through concentration camps, through technology-induced earth changes, and through negative alien assistance. That's what bad guys want, but it might not work out that way in the end. Although there will be many unpleasantries, the NWO game plan will eventually collapse in great chaos and upheaval caused by war here in American soil against Russia and China, possible earth changes, and other unexpected events. These types of articles, while likely true, are also presented in such a way to keep you fearful. As we have recently seen with the Iraq invasion, the propaganda about U.S. military prowess might not have been taken into account the will to resist an army of imperialist invaders by ordinary Iraqi citizens, called paramilitary personnel in the U.S. corporate press. The good people of this earth are now getting more assistance than ever to overcome the dark forces of tyranny and enslavement. We now have the etheric tools available to us to neutralize and render ineffective the genocide agenda. To learn more, read The Adventures of Don and Carol Croft. It seems that planet Earth will experience a gradual vibration uplift between now and the year 2017. The parasites are hoping to abort that and keep their slaves dumb and indentured, but we're moving up whether they like it or not. See the latest from Montauk on this theme as well.
Okay. And,
well, they didn't really.
In the summer of 2000, someone presents...
That's a posting.
Okay. I don't know. I think it's interesting anyway that that's what's going on. But it is it's a hoax in the extent that that's it. I remember when we spoke to Jim Mars, who said that he wrote the alien agenda and so on, and he said that McNamara, who's then
Robert McNamara,
who was he's dead now, but he was the defense secretary under Johnson. He told Jim that the Cold War was over and it was. And the next thing was going to be terrorism, all right? And then after terrorism...
Exhausts itself,
which it's about to do now, is going to become aliens, okay? And this is what the hoax was about. This is what people are, to keep the war going and keep the military...
To keep people in fear.
And keep people in fear. So, that's it's kind of fascinating that it's all been planned out, And it's what amazes me is how... mainstream media can lie so well, so bold-faced, such bold-faced liars, just unbelievable, and never get anything out of them. Okay. There was a couple of videos here that I wanted to mention, but...
Pilots killing civilians and loving it.
Yeah. This is a 3-minute video. We'll see if we have the sound on.
From April 2004, first major U.S. attack on Fallujah.
Which includes the moment at which the American...
Pentagon gun film footage. This is what this is. Yeah. I don't know what this is going to be.
Which includes the moment at which the Americans carry out their attack. You may find it deeply upsetting.
Tonight, for the first time, you will see something of what happens in the unreported war. For days, American and Iraqi forces have killed scores of civilians in Samarra as they seize the town from the insurgents. For successive nights, they've bombed Fallujah in preparation to do the same here. And once they decided to bomb cities, they decided to accept the routine killing of civilians as the price for hitting their target.
it is inevitable that some innocent people are going to get killed, maybe in a higher proportion to the enemy that you kill. And this whole philosophy of using air power to back up ground forces is incredibly risky once it's done within an urban area where not everybody is an enemy.
What follows is a rare glimpse inside America's disastrous attempts to seize Fallujah from the insurgents back in April. At the time, there were reports of hundreds of bodies piling up at the hospital. But until now, we've had little real idea of how American pilots actually go about bombing in built-up areas. The Pentagon's confirmed that what you're about to see is cockpit video from a U.S. Air Force F-16 fighter shot in April. The pilot tells ground control, "I've got numerous individuals on the road. Shall I take them out?" He's instantly told, "Take them out."
"I got numerous individuals on the road. Do you want me to take those out?" "Take them out."
The pilot locks the bomb guidance system onto the crowd running along the street.
10 seconds.
About
20 or 30
people are walking down the road and having a ceremony.
It looks like a funeral.
Yeah,
it looks like a
funeral.
Impact.
The pilot's reaction, "Oh, dude. Overnight, Channel 4 News received the following email.
From Lieutenant Colonel Frank Smolinski, Chief Air Force Press Desk, Pentagon. This video is indeed gun film footage from a U.S. Air Force F-16 fighter. The mission was not recent. It was in April 2004. This was a close air support mission flown by an F-16 Fighting Falcon in the Fallujah vicinity and under the command of a Joint Terminal Attack Controller serving with ground forces in the area. The JTAC designated the target and confirmed the hit."
And what does the confirmed hit tell us? Well, primarily, the decision was taken incredibly quickly. It's just 32 seconds from the pilot telling ground control he's seen this crowd to the deaths of 30 or so people.
Well, you can see from this film that the decision to drop this weapon was made very, very quickly. In fact, the target was seen by the pilot of the aircraft, not from anyone controlling the battle on the ground. It was the aircraft who saw these individuals emerging from around the corner. He says, "I have a target," and in an exchange of just a few words, he's given clearance to drop. Obviously, the situation is that critical, that this can happen in 5 or 6 words.
The video graphically illustrates U.S. rules of engagement in practice in Iraq.
That's a sick thing, isn't it? Hey, that's really sick. It shows...
To deliberately drop a bomb on people. They weren't doing anything.
They were just, it looked like it was a ceremony. It could have been
a funeral.
Could
have been
anything.
A wedding. Could have been a procession. Could have been going to someone's house.
Could have been something, but there was at least
20 or 30 people.
They
weren't trying to hurt anybody.
They were just walking. And the guy says, "Oh, there's people there. Oh, that's good. Let's blow them up." And they just shot their bombs at them. And it's freaking unbelievable. I mean, you know, you just can't. And the guy did it so nonchalantly, like, "Oh, dude." You know?
It wasn't his family.
No, he didn't care. Oh, man. It's like, you know.
Cold-blooded.
Ah, ah.
You go to hell for things like that.
Oh, God, they're already there. Ah. This is
Israel puts uranium into orange juice.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Human experiment horror as workers lured into drinking uranium juice. Let's check this out.
Juice laced with uranium is just one of many clinical trials allegedly conducted at an Israeli nuclear power plant. Well, a human rights activist has accused the plant's management of forcing its workers to take part in life-threatening experiments or for the sake of nuclear developments. They also claim the government and the military are involved in a cover-up of the tests.
It's taken a decade for them to speak out, but workers at Israel's nuclear reactor facility claim their managers gave them uranium to drink as part of an experiment. With no medical supervision or explanation of the risks, the workers now want compensation.
They told me that the managers of the laboratory approached a few workers within the laboratory and asked them if they are ready to volunteer for a research that they are doing. And when they said yes, they were asked to drink juices, grapefruit and orange juice, with the uranium.
Professor Zvi Benfrich is a doctor and human rights campaigner who says Israel still lacks the laws to protect its people against clinical trials like this. He believes the claims are plausible.
My guess is that the idea was to see what is the amount of uranium that is present in drinking water or in something ingestible that would show by the regular detection methods.
The government's response is confusing, insisting it never happened while suggesting an investigation.
Israeli authorities deny the claims. In a statement emailed to our officers, they explicitly say there have been no human experiments at the Negev Nuclear Center. What's more, they write that the CEO of the Israel Atomic Energy Commission has decided to put together an expert team. They won't give any statement until the investigation is complete.
These aren't the first such allegations in Israel. Zuri Tahan was a teenage army officer drafted with 700 other soldiers to find an anthrax vaccine. They were told the test was safe, but 10 years on, many still suffer skin and breathing problems, headaches and stomach pains.
We were soldiers, young soldiers, highly motivated. We believed with all our hearts in the army, in the state, so we had no reason not to participate in that.
Similar claims emerged from naval troops, saying they were ordered to dive into water polluted by toxic waste. Many developed cancer. It took years for the incidents to come to light. From the military, a flat denial. So, at the nuclear reactor, it's no surprise to people like Gideon Spiro that there's great pressure on workers in sensitive jobs to keep quiet. He led the campaign to free Mordechai Vanunu, the whistleblower jailed for 18 years for revealing Israel's atomic weapons work.
One of our demands is to open the Dimona for international inspection to know what's exactly happening, not only with the manufacturing of nuclear weapons, but also how about dealing with the nuclear waste, for instance?
Israelis have always seen the reactor as their protector from enemy attack. But allegations of medical tests on people and an ever-growing official wall of silence could force some to consider whether it's becoming a public enemy. Paul Isler, RT.
That's interesting because that,
Well, they take it a step further than they have it in this country.
No, you don't know. I mean, these guys are sick. But this is the Israeli army, the Israeli government, testing their own people with uranium in orange juice. I mean, it's like this sick sound of it. Anyway, this is, Lyle and I will read this because, it's all right, but it's an interesting video, but it's one that you have to kind of read. You can't really, there's no real talking in it. But it's a mysterious death of 9/11 witnesses. Yeah.
Public outcry is working to stop. Oh, that's a different one.
We'll read that in a minute. But this one's kind of important. But again, like I said, we're going to have to read it to you because
So there's more than one. Many 9/11 witnesses have been mysteriously dying. The thing these witnesses have in common is that their statements give support to the 9/11 truth movement.
Huh. Barry Jennings.
Doesn't say anything else.
Barry Jennings was the former New York Housing Authority emergency coordinator. On 9/11, Barry Jennings reported that he and Michael Hess had been blown back by a big explosion inside Building 7.
He later said in an interview that he had heard explosions in Building 7 before either tower had collapsed.
He also reported that he was stepping over bodies, contradicting the official government claim that no one died in Building 7.
Barry died mysteriously on August 19, 2008, 2 days before the release of the NIST report's first draft.
Okay. Barry Eckert.
Beverly.
Beverly Eckert. Beverly Eckert lost her husband on 9/11.
She did not believe the official story of 9/11.
She was among the families organizing for a disclosure around the fact of September 11, including a lawsuit against the Saudi and U.S. government. I think she was the one that was killed by the plane.
She was offered money by the U.S. government to keep silent, but Beverly did not comply.
Eckert died at age 57 in a mysterious commuter airplane crash on February 12, 2009.
That was in Albany.
Right.
A week before she died, she met with President Barack Obama as an advocate for those affected by 9/11.
Remember when that happened? Just last year. Kenneth Johannenman, Joanman. Kenneth was a janitor at the WTC. He reported seeing explosions in the basement and upper floors at the lower level. Johannenman reported a massive explosion.
Side note makes it appear as if the reason for the suicide was eviction. Johannenman had a large and loving family. One of his cousins had offered him a place.
Michael H. Doran.
Mr. Doran was a 9/11 victims lawyer who volunteered his services to help the victims of the 9/11 attacks receive compensation.
He died on April 28, 2009, with his single-engine plane crashed in Ohio. I remember that.
Christopher Landis.
No photo available yet. They're showing photos here. But former operations manager for Safety Service Patrol for the Virginia Department of Transportation.
Pentagon. He gave the makers of the Pentagon a film photo collection and nervously answered their questions. He had an unobstructed view of the Pentagon crash site and amazing unseen pictures showing of a cover-up. Pictures also showed 9/11 perps in their government vehicles.
There's some of the pictures. They're showing, no plane there, though.
Nope.
About a week after the filmmakers had obtained the Citgo witnesses' testimony on film, Christopher Landis committed suicide. No further info has been released on his death. Reminds me of the JFK witnesses, over 400 of them that were killed.
Bertha Champagne. Bertha was the babysitter for 9/11 perp Marvin Bush's family.
Marvin P. Bush, the little-known younger brother of George W. Bush, was a director of Securecom Stratasec, a Kuwaiti Saudi-backed company, until June 2000.
The company that provided the electronic security to the World Trade Center in the days before the attacks and provided security to Dulles International Airport, where Flight 77 took off from.
On 9/11, Marv Bush was on the board of HCC Insurance Holdings, Inc., which insured parts of the World Trade Center.
October 10, 2003, 62-year-old Bertha Champagne was found crushed to death by her own vehicle in a driveway in front of the Bush family home.
My God. They killed her right there.
Wonder what she knew.
Probably too much.
What did she know?
Paul Smith.
Chopper 7 pilot of ABC's 9/11 International Shot Chopper who caught the second plane fly into the tower.
Showing a picture of the plane crashing in.
On October 7, 2007, Paul Smith was killed when he was run over by a cab driver who was cut off by a black car. The black car has not been identified. sort of like Princess Diana.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Cameraman John Del Giorno was on the chopper with Paul Smith on 9/11.
John Del Giorno confirms he was the cameraman in News Chopper 7 on 9/11 who took the first footage aired alive, allegedly, of United Airlines Flight 175 hitting the second tower.
John Del Giorno has refused to talk about what he saw on 9/11 and no longer responds to reporters.
I don't blame him.
I don't either.
Did someone tell him not to talk about what they really witnessed?
Deborah Palfrey ran a prostitution ring that had top 9/11 perps among its clients.
Former NASA official noted that some of Palfrey's call girls were being chauffeured by Shirlington limousines to poker parties attended by former CIA director and co-chair of the Joint 9/11 Intelligence Inquiry, Porter Grossoff.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That's skanky, isn't it?
Yep. There he is.
Self-righteous.
One of the reasons cited for Goss's abrupt resignation in May 2006 was his alleged involvement in the prostitution scandal. I think she was the one that was found hung.
On the morning of 9/11, Goss was having breakfast with the head of Pakistan's Inter-Service of Intelligence, General Mahmoud Ahmed, the man who ordered a wire transfer of $100,000 to the alleged lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta.
Jesus.
All tied up.
Sorry, folks, about that interruption. According to former NSA official Wayne Madsen, Palfrey may have... Oh, God, what happened here? Okay, hold on a second.
That's not the same one.
No, it is the same one. It's just missing the mark here. Former NSA official Wayne Madsen, Palfrey may have also known that Jack Abramoff, who was also connected to the
D.C. Madam scandal, allowed at least two of the 9/11 hijackers to use one of the casino's boats.
Holy cow.
Jeez. In the days before 9/11, Abramoff, there's a picture of him. He's a creep. Deborah Palfrey said, I have information that would have been of the greatest interest to the 9/11 commission.
She was the prostitute.
And she was killed.
She was the madam,
wasn't
right?
She?
Yep. There's information that they have that would have been very important to the 9/11 commission to know, having to do with intelligence they picked up about 9/11 before it happened.
This is a clip from the Alex Jones show where he interviewed Deborah Palfrey. She didn't say what she was going to expose because she wanted to do that in court.
And she wound up dying.
There's a picture of her.
I think we can get this in a second here.
I have no intention of letting anyone buy me off or make any kind of a deal with me.
And you're not planning to commit suicide.
And I'm not planning to commit suicide either.
The fact that you're so visible really protects you going on Larry King and other big shows, but you want to put it on record that you're not planning to commit suicide?
No, I'm not planning to commit suicide. I'm planning to go into court on April 7th if indeed we do have the trial, and I plan on defending myself vigorously, and I plan on exposing the government in ways that, you know, I do not think they want me to expose them.
April 15th, 2008.
Law enforcement about their investigation into the D.C. matter.
When she went outside, she noticed a three-wheel bicycle had been moved that was normally kept in the shed. Upon entering the shed located on the west side of the residence, Blanche Palfrey discovered her daughter, Deborah, had apparently hung herself using a nylon rope from a metal beam on the ceiling of the shed. She then called 911. At approximately 11:01 a.m., Tarpon Springs Fire Rescue had pronounced Deborah Jean Palfrey deceased.
They murdered her.
Major General Worley. Worley was the officer who scrambled fighter jets into Washington skies on 9/11. On June 22, 2009, Major General David Worley was killed when two commuter trains crashed into... I remember that well. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, that was the commuter train crash. Yeah.
Both trains were ripped open and smashed together in the worst accident in the Metro Rail system's 33 years history.
Remember that. And
investigators determined that the striking train was under automatic rather than manual control.
And
Salvatore Princiotta.
Salvatore Princiotta is a first responder firefighter from Ladder 9. These are actual pics of the Ladder 9 fire truck that is showing. Oh, okay.
Looks like a regular truck.
Yeah.
You can see the windows have been blown out. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You can see the glass and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. The windows gasket is on the outside. What blew out the windows?
It didn't blow out just the middle portion of the windows. It blew out the windows all the way back to the frame where it was mounted.
Oh.
Okay. And on May 23rd, 2007, Salvatore Princiotta was found murdered. What did he really witness?
David Graham. David Graham saw three of the alleged hijackers in Shreveport with a Pakistani businessman prior to 9/11. He came to the FBI with this information and received threats from federal agents. Jesus. On September 17, 2006, David Graham was found poisoned to death. Graham's death was never investigated. Just a coincidence? Yeah, right. Video made by Kevin 604BC.
Okay. Man.
That's pretty scary, isn't it?
Yeah. Hijacked passengers of Flight 93. Here's what this is.
Then I guess about I didn't answer the phone until the last time she called, which was at something to that. It was towards the almost close to 10 o'clock by that time. And then that's when I get the phone call from her, and I actually had a chance to speak with her. And I'm waking up out of a sleep, and she just saying, "Babe, listen." And I'm like, "I'm listening." And she said, "My plane has been hijacked," and I just stopped playing, you know, because I'm just waking up. You thinking that it's, she's, you know, but she ain't never, she said, "I've never played with you like that." She said, "Listen to me." I heard the fear in her voice. I heard the fear. I heard the desperation in her voice to get out what she had to say. And she said, "My plane has been hijacked. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going to happen. But, you know, all I know is this: I love you." She said, "I love you. Tell my boys I love them. I don't know if I'm going to see you guys again. And I'm like, at this point, my heart is like beating. I'm like, am I dreaming? Am I sleeping? You know, I didn't know whether I was still dreaming or what. I didn't know whether it was real or what. So, but I'm listening. So at that point, I stopped. I said, okay, well, let's pray. So we prayed. And then she told me, well, you know, we're getting ready to go to the cockpit. And I'm like, I'm trying to figure out what she's saying. I hear people in the background screaming, and I hear some bamming. And she said, okay, it's getting ready to happen, And then we got disconnected. And then that was the last I spoke to her. Then once the phone got disconnected, then I sat up in the bed because I did all this laying down. I sat up in the bed like, it was like I just woke up. I'm like, was that a real call? So I looked at the caller ID and noticed that it was a call, and it was from her cell phone. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. How could she call me from on the plane from a cell phone? Because cell phones don't work on the plane. That's what I'm thinking.
Same. Yeah. And there was reports that Flight 93 was actually
Well, what happened to the people?
No, that was the big question. Where did they go? You know, were they all killed or what? This is interesting here that we might be a little follow-up here. Flight 93 witness states there were no bodies.
On fire, some small fires in the woods, just small brush fires. You know, the ground smoking, debris everywhere, pieces of metal, paper, insulation, wiring. And I just looked around and no people, you know, and I'm thinking, where are the people?
So those people aboard Flight 93 who resisted the hijackers are now being remembered as heroes in the history of the United States for preventing a calamity from being an even worse one. Stephen?
So much is known about this flight.
Yeah, that's the insanity of the whole thing. And there were no witnesses. There were no...
No bodies.
No bodies. And actually, there remains. There wasn't even a plane. It looked more like a missile or a drone of some sort that had crashed. So there are so many unanswered questions to this that we'll never...
Really know the answers.
According to Wayne Mansfelder, may have also had known that Jack Abramoff, who was also connected to the D.C. Matter scandal, allowed at least two of the 9/11 hijackers to use a boat. Right?
Yeah, we read that.
That's 15 minutes. That's
And IST special safety and urgent, oh, we did that urgent warning about.
About tall buildings. Let's see. This is mostly from yesterday. Depleted uranium haunts Kosovo and Iraq. Iraq and Kosovo may be thousands of miles apart, but they share the dubious distinction of contamination and radioactive residue from depleted uranium bullets used in American airstrikes. After several years of silence, U.S. officials finally admitted that 340 tons of depleted uranium were fired during the Gulf War. In Kosovo, Americans delays in providing details of quantities and target points have frustrated international efforts to assess health risks. Despite repeated requests, NATO waited almost a full year after the start of bombing in March 99 to say that 31,000 DU bullets, a fraction of the number fired in Iraq, were fired at A-10 tank busters aircraft over Kosovo. A Belgrade report published that this April estimates that over 50,000 depleted uranium bullets had been used in part of Serbia and Montenegro, as well as Kosovo. The evidence is plentiful on the ground that DU was used in heavy populated areas, and that civilians and returning refugees were never warned of the danger.
The high-density bullet is made of low-level radioactive waste left over from manufacturing nuclear fuel and bombs. Depleted uranium bullets were designed in the 1970s to defeat top-line Soviet tanks. Some 20 nations now keep the world's best armor-piercing rounds in their arsenals. First used in combat during the Gulf War, they proved to be unmatched tank slayers. A Pentagon official points to one of the benefits the U.S. can give away its 1.2 billion pound stockpile of radioactive waste to weapons manufacturers. When depleted uranium smashes into a hard target, it pulverizes into breathable dust that remains radioactive for 4.5 billion years. American nuclear scientists have found that depleted uranium dust can travel at least 26 miles. Scientists of the National Institute for Health Protection in Macedonia detected 8 times higher than normal levels of alpha radiation, the primary type emitted by depleted uranium, in the air during the Ir War. Yugoslav soldiers have found DU rounds in Bujanovic in the south, and Swiss-led international team found serious radioactivity when it dug up many rounds at a radio tower near Vranje, I don't know.
Yeah, and despite predicting that every future battlefield will be contaminated with DU, the Pentagon asserts that DU risk is minimal. The training materials developed in the 1990s require full protective gear and masks in contaminated areas, in line with Nuclear Regulatory Commission rules. The U.S. military requires an NRC license to handle the smallest amount of restricted material. A U.S. Army Commission health report, issued just days before the Gulf War, noted that radiation is linked with cancer and said that no dose of depleted uranium is so low that the probability of effect is zero.
Still, depending on, argues that
residual DU on battlefields in Kosovo does not pose a significant risk to human health.
Yeah, right.
If you see some of these horrible pictures,
you'd think twice about that. U.S. soldiers partly ascribe Gulf War syndrome to DU exposure. British troops deployed in Kosovo are suing the Defense Ministry for ailments they attribute to DU. The UN Refugee Agency in Kosovo now includes papers in personnel files to note work in potentially DU-contaminated areas. In Kosovo, Western demining groups were told by NATO to exercise caution and not to climb over destroyed armored vehicles. Last October, Colonel Eric Daxon, the U.S. Army's top radiological expert, said The best thing I can tell anybody about entering a contaminated vehicle or a damaged vehicle is don't do it. It's a dangerous place to be.
But that message never got through to hundreds of thousands of Kosovar Albanians in whose name the Kosovo campaign was fought. And those DU exposures could be highest. Rex Hamaj, a mechanic who lost most of his tools during the conflict, didn't think twice about salvaging parts from destroyed Serbian vehicles. Like thousands of returning refugees, he was just glad to get back to work.
But the concrete service of Serbian military base on the west side of Dvorjavakova, where I found him working, was pockmarked with DU hits, as was the nearby road. The ground was littered with spent aluminum shell casings that are unique to 30 millimeter depleted uranium bullets. A boy climbed on a burned-out armored vehicle, then jumped off and kicked a shell casing.
Now I know it's dangerous, but that is a risk I've got to take, said Hamaj. And the telltale casings are explained.
His hands were greasy black with work.
If the Americans didn't use the stuff, then we might still have Serbs here. On the other hand, I hope they clean it up. But cleanup is virtually impossible. One U.S. Defense Department reports list 8 soil contamination techniques, including multiple nitric acid and washes. But in no case did the achieved separation suffice to allow unrestricted disposal.
A confidential preliminary UN report leaked in May 1999 as the bombing continued did not mince words. This type of ammunition is nuclear waste. Its use is very dangerous and harmful. It said after NATO released its figures, the UN recommended the measures should be taken to prevent access. For Kosovars, like Iraqi, such warnings may be too late.
They are too late. It's just, you know,
terrible.
It's horrible.
It's a criminal act.
It's a criminal act.
It's a terrible thing to do.
It's a war crime. I mean, it's an absolute war crime.
I mean, there's no other word for it to use that.
I mean, how do you justify doing that to people? Yeah, you gotta.
And you're doing it to your own people too, who are using it.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not telling those people. You know?
And you shoot something, it pulverizes, goes into dust. The wind blows back at you.
To 26 miles. I mean, there are bases all around there.
They don't care.
People living everywhere. This stuff just, goes and kills everybody. Iraq has the highest rate of infant birth deformities in the world right now, okay, and it's due to depleted uranium. And it's like, it's one in three children that are born have a major birth defect, okay, in Iraq. All right, it's frightening.
Bankers inflate speculative food bubble. How about this? Never let a good crisis go to waste. The international bankers are taking advantage of the food crisis by driving up food prices in what is shaping up to be a classic case of a manufactured bubble. It is also looking like a clear model of problem-reaction-solution methodology. Create the food inflation problem, of course profiting all the way up, force an enraged reaction among the public, and take more sovereignty away with solutions of global food regulation.
Yep.
How about George Carlin? That would be good.
This is kind of a long article, but...
Yeah.
They're just trying to screw around with the food supply, and they're doing a good job at it.
How about this? George Carlin, The Illusion of Choice.
He's on Bill Maher's.
This might be interesting.
Yeah.
The paradigm shift.
We like war. We like war. We're a warlike people. We like war because we're good at it. You know why we're good at it? Because we get a lot of practice. This country's only 200 years old, and already we've had 10 major wars. We average a major war every 20 years in this country, so we're good at it. And it's a good thing we are. We're not very good at anything else anymore. Can't build a decent car. Can't make a TV set or a VCR worth a fuck. Got no steel industry left, can't educate our young people, can't get health care to our old people, but we can bomb the shit out of your country, all right? Especially if your country is full of brown people. That's our new job in the world, bombing brown people. Iraq, Panama, Grenada, Libya, you got some brown people in your country. Tell them to watch the fuck out, or we'll goddamn bomb them. Well, when's the last white people you can remember that we bombed? Can you remember the last white? Can you remember any white people we've ever bombed? The Germans, those are the only ones, and that's only because they were trying to cut in on our action. They wanted to dominate the world. Bullshit, that's our fucking job. You probably noticed I don't feel about that war the way we were told we were supposed to feel about that war, the way we were ordered and instructed by the United States government to feel about that war. My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinion. I don't just roll over when I'm told to. Sad to say, most Americans just roll over on command, not me. I have certain rules under my. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. Nothing. No. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country, who in the case of the Persian Gulf War were nothing more than unpaid employees of the Department of Defense, and who most of the time function as kind of an unofficial public relations agency for the United States government. So I don't listen to them. I don't really believe in my country. I gotta tell you folks, don't get all choked up about yellow ribbons and American flag. I consider them to be symbols, and I leave symbols to the symbol-minded. I'm talking about the fact that a war is a rich old men protecting their property by sending middle class and lower class young men off to die. Forget these foolish elections. The owners of this country don't care about the poor in general.
Owners and they don't
country,
care about
what are we going. Is this Karl Marx talking to me?
The owners of this country are
no.
The voters of this country.
No, you're wrong about that.
Aren't the owners of this country the voters in this country?
No, they're not. Listen, the politics, these elections are a charade. They are not true. Elections and politicians are in place in order to give Americans the illusion that they have freedom of choice. You don't really have choice in this country. All the things that are important reduced in choice. Newspapers in the city, how many? Used to be 3-4, now it's 1 or 2, they're owned by the same people, and they also own a radio station. Give these people a voting day every year so that they'll have the illusion of meaningless choice. Meaningless choice that we go like slaves and say, God, I voted. The limits of debate in this country are established before the debate even begins, and everyone else is marginalized. They're made to seem either to be communist or some sort of disloyal person. A kook, there's a word. And now it's conspiracy. See, they've made that something that should not be even entertained for a minute, that powerful people might get together and have a plan. Doesn't happen. You're a kook. You're a conspiracy buff.
Not as a result of a conspiracy, but
you don't need a formal conspiracy.
Right.
When interests converge, these people went to the same universities and fraternities, they're on the same boards of directors, they're in the same country clubs, they have like interests, they don't need to call a meeting, they know what's good for them, and they're getting it. And there used to be 7 oil companies, there are now 3, it will soon be 2. The things that matter in this country have been reduced in choice. There are 2 political parties, there are a handful of insurance companies, there are about 6 or 7 information things. What if you want a bagel? There are 23 flavors because you have the illusion. You have the illusion of choice.
Right.
You don't get the real importance. There's no freedom of choice.
Like that, why did he have to die?
Pickard didn't take it, I guess. He had a bad cocaine problem for most of his life.
So,
know, he's, what can I say? Anyway, we got about 6 more minutes. I thought this was kind of interesting. The Department of Justice refuses to revoke BP's probation over safety violations at its Texas City refinery. The Department of Justice has refused to pursue a probation revocation case against BP after the company was found to have violated a federal judge's March 2009 felony judgment, which required BP to fulfill the terms of settlement agreement it entered into the government regulators 5 years ago to make safety upgrades at the Texas refinery, according to the documents obtained by Truthout. Instead, the DOJ, Department of Justice, has allowed BP to spend 2 additional years to correct hundreds of safety violations that have plagued the refinery, the third largest in the country, for a decade, and have played a part in the deaths of 19 people over the past 5 years. Now, this is just typical of BP. I mean, you know, they just continue to do that. They killed 11, rig workers, all right? And countless...
Without a blink of the eye.
And how many... Countless other people that have been sick and dying and, you know, oh, God... They have no concern, and the Department of Justice just continues to, under Obama, and prior to that, under Bush, they just let the BP just keep on rolling without any penalties. It's disgusting. On March 2005...
Well, I think they have some penalties. They just don't have... They're not in proportion to the amount of money they make.
No, but they don't even implement them. They don't even give them
penalties.
They
never get paid.
They never get paid. They stall. They continue to do it, just like Valdez did. ExxonMobil. In March 23rd, 2005, 15 people were killed. 170 others were maimed and seriously injured in an explosion at the plant, which occurred during the startup of the refinery's octane-boosting isomerization unit, where the distillation tower and attached blow-down drum were overfilled with highly flammable liquid hydrocarbons. Because the blowdown drum vented directly into the atmosphere, there was a geyser-like release of highly flammable liquid and vapor into the ground of the refinery. And according to a 2-year investigation conducted by the Department Independent U.S. Chemical Safety Board, a diesel pickup truck that was idling nearby ignited the vapor, and initiating a series of explosions and fires that swept through the unit and surrounding areas. Fatalities and injuries occurred in around occupied work trailers, which were placed too close to the unit and which were not evacuated prior to the startup. BP operated the blowdown drum, which was part of the refinery's dilapidated safety system, even though it was known that the alarms in the system were malfunctioning. BP had been told numerous times to replace it with a flare system, which would have prevented or greatly minimized the severity of the accident. But internal BP documents show that the company refused to invest the funds to upgrade the system. And John Breslin, CSB's chairman, said his agency probe completed in 2007 found organizational safety deficiencies at all levels of the BP Corporation. Our investigation team turned up extensive evidence showing a catastrophe waiting to happen, Breslin said on March 24th. The 5th anniversary of the refinery explosion. Cost-cutting had affected safety programs and critical maintenance. Production pressures resulted in costly mistakes made by workers likely fatigued by working long hours. Internal audits and safety studies brought problems to the attention of BP's board in London, but they were not sufficiently acted upon. Okay, the October 2007 BP Production North America and the Justice Department announced they reached a settlement, which called for BP to plead guilty to a felony Clean Air Act violation and pay a $50 million fine. But the victims of the refinery explosion successfully held up the plea agreement for 18 months after the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that they were not properly consulted under the Federal Crimes Victims Act before the plea deal between the government and BP was hammered out behind closed doors. And the victims objected to the plea deal, saying the negotiated fine was not large enough considering BP reaped more than $1 billion in profits by operating the refinery illegally, and BPPNA's parent company, BP PLC, was immunized as part of the settlement, when that evidence showed it played a direct role in the decisions that led to the blast. I mean, this is the crap that's been going on, and it went on, and it continued to go on in the Gulf. In the Gulf, the plea agreement and the terms of, however, District Court Judge Lee Rosenthal accepted the plea agreement and formally placed BP on 3-year probation. She told the victim she could not rewrite the plea agreement; she could only accept it or reject it. The plea agreement and the terms of BP's probation, according to Judge Rosenthal's judgment order, were contingent upon BP correcting safety violations at the refinery discovered in the aftermath of the disaster. As part of a separate settlement agreement, BP entered into the September 2005, the Occupational Safety Administration and the Texas Commission. I mean, it goes on and on. I'm going to refer you to this article because it's very lengthy. But it's critical that you check it out. And it's Ukrnet, URUKNET.info. And it's called DOJ Refuses to Revoke BP Probation.
And in the meantime, we're right out of time.
We are out of time.
It's the end of the show, and I'm going to say goodnight
and
talk to you Friday.
Yeah, I want to thank everybody.
We will probably talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah, and join me tomorrow when we enter the fourth dimension. And but I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and hope you enjoyed yourself. And have a good evening.